You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, January 19th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And as is the tradition around here, rather than do a show, we're going to take the day off and provide for you some curated clips of Martin Luther King. It's largely the same show that we've done or built over the past couple of years. However, we've included something new to the mix. It's a series of clips, like I said. The first one, and it's actually quite long, nearly 25 minutes long. It is Martin Luther King's first interview on national television on a show called The Open Mind. And the subtitle of this episode was The New Negro. And this is from, I think it's 1962, if I remember correctly. Oh, I'm sorry, 1957. So it's very early. And it's fascinating. I guess what I found really interesting about this was just the way they're talking, just the way all of them are talking. It's hosted by this guy, Richard Hefner, who I guess was a Rutgers professor and the host of this program. And the other guest was a federal judge, a South Carolina federal judge, who named Julius Wattis Waring. And he's an interesting figure because he was, you know, sort of initially a sort of a moderate and then became fairly radical in terms of what he felt had to be done in terms of segregation. So there's the three of them sitting at a Charlie Rose table, if I don't mind saying so myself. So we've collected this. Is, you know, you can find this online. It's a three-part YouTube, but we wanted to put it together here. Then following that, we head into basically what is we have built over the past couple of years. Then you hear an excerpt from a short excerpt from the Frank McGee Sunday Report, which was a profile on Martin Luther King. But it's from May 7th, 1967. It's on NBC News. And you can see that the host is, I don't know much about Frank McGee, but the host is talking about MLK's transition, or I guess evolution, or I'm not sure exactly how to express it, but it's not just about civil rights, or I should say civil rights have expanded into a broader social justice program. And then there's a brief excerpt from a speech that he did really a month before, or just days before, in Cleveland, Ohio, just to give you an idea of where he was at that time. Then we include an extended excerpt of a well-known sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church on April 30th, 1967. Of course, it is he is now talking about a broader social justice campaign. There is then we hear Walter Cronkite's famous report of his assassination a year later. And then we finish up with Nina Simone singing a song that was recorded live 3 days after the death of Martin Luther King. And she talks about the assassination and sings the song. It's pretty moving. And then for members, we have MLK's last speech entitled Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution, which was delivered, of course, in Washington, D.C. on March 31st. 1968. It was the last formal speech or big speech that he gave, and that was at the National Cathedral in Washington. So enjoy that. Have a good Martin Luther King Day. I hope you enjoy listening to this stuff. I think it's important. You know, this is something I do with Myla every year. We sit down, we listen to a bunch of speeches just so she has, you know, some semblance of this guy in her consciousness on this day. Great American and important for all of us. Okay, so we'll be back live tomorrow, Tuesday.
The Open Mind. Free to examine, to question, to disagree. Our subject today, the new Negro. Your host on The Open Mind is Richard D. Heffner, author and historian.
I think it's safe to say that the lot of the Negro in America has, throughout our history, deeply bothered the conscience of each and every one of us who deeply believes in traditional American principles of democracy and liberty and justice and freedom. I think this may be a little less true today than ever before, and yet for the larger part of American history, I think we ought to realize that the Negro more or less was in slavery. I think the Negro was more likely to be a slave for the greater part of our history than not. And quite naturally, the attitude of the Negro towards the white, of the white towards the Negro, and of the Negro towards himself has been conditioned and tempered and molded in very large part by the fact of a long history of slavery. Besides, I think it's important to remember that slavery as an institution put a premium not upon self-assertiveness and the understanding of one's own human dignity, but upon acquiescence by the Negro slave. And I think that one can fairly say that the acquiescent, submissive Negro slave was generally, well, to put it very bluntly, generally safer than the self-assertive Negro who is conscious of his own human dignity and of the democratic philosophy that is the American heritage. As a matter of fact, I think we could admit that the whole myth that we have built up about the Old South, in which slavery existed, has been a myth in which we see the picture of the happy, acquiescent slave. The Negro is a slave. The Negro who is acquiescent is happy. The Negro who is happy is, by definition, acquiescent. Negroes are happy because they accept their lot. And think of the movies and the books and the plays and the novels that we read and see about slavery in the Old South. We see the Negro who is acquiescent as happy. The Negro slave who is self-assertive, who looks for his own rights, is considered a troublemaker. Even when slavery was brought to an end by the Civil War, it was said that acquiescence and acceptance by the Negro of his lot, well, these were the greater part of wisdom. It was said that the Negro could gain more by submerging his own sense of dignity than by asserting it. That the Negro would so antagonize others by demanding his own rights that it was better for him to bide his time at each step along the way, wait for something to be given to him rather than demand it as of his own right. Well, men of goodwill, I think both Negro and white cannot deny that to some extent there is validity in this argument. But the degree of that extent, to what extent this is true, is the question that we must face today. In recent years, there have grown up leaders amongst both Negroes and whites who feel that a just and a wise self-assertiveness is necessary on the part of the Negro. there has been emerging in our own times a new Negro, a Negro who is aware of his own dignity and of the American tradition of liberty and justice. We want to talk today about that new Negro, about who he is and what he is, and our guests are quite expert in the subject. My first guest is the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. of Montgomery, Alabama. Reverend King has been very much involved in the demand by the new Negro for his rights in the Negro bus boycott in Montgomery and in many other instances. My second guest is a jurist, Judge J. Wades Waring, formerly federal judge in South Carolina, a gentleman whose decisions in the area of segregation paved the way in a very real sense for what became in 1954 the Supreme Court's decision that segregation in our public schools is unconstitutional. Well, gentlemen, suppose we begin this discussion by letting me, well, first ask you, Dr. King, in your estimation, what and who is this new Negro?
I think I could best answer that question by saying first that the new Negro is a person with a new sense of dignity and destiny, with a new self-respect. Along with that, is this like a fear which once characterized the Negro, this willingness to stand up courageously for what he feels is just and what he feels he deserves on the basis of the laws of the land. I think also included would be this self-assertive attitude that you just mentioned. And all of these factors come together to make what seems to me to be the new Negro. I think also I would like to mention this growing honesty which characterizes the Negro today. There was a time that the Negro used duplicity or deception to, rather as a survival technique. Although he didn't particularly like conditions, he said he liked them because he felt that the boss wanted to hear that. But now from the housetops, from the kitchen, from the classrooms, and from the pulpits, the Negro says in no uncertain terms that he doesn't like the way he's being treated. So at long last, the Negro is telling the truth. And I think this is also one of the basic characteristics of the new Negro.
Judge Waring, does this sound like an adequate description of the Negro whom you know today?
Honest Hafner, I think it's excellent. It's an excellent summary. My observation of the Negro, and I'm speaking in generalities, of course, has been that up to recently he's been a half-man or a part-man. And now at last he's waking up to the fact that he's a whole man, that he's an American citizen. And that he is entitled to rights no more, no less, than just the ordinary run-of-the-mill American citizen. He's never had that before. He hasn't been allowed to have it. He's been under political domination. He's been under stress. He's been under economic deprivations. He's been a servant, formerly a slave. And now suddenly I see the idea has come to him that he's really, truly a man that can stand up on his own hind legs and tell the truth and say, I want not any special privilege. I don't want any special handout. I don't want to be given anything because the giving idea is all wrong. But I want a chance to become a full man and do my part, be it little or be it big, in the community of our country.
But doesn't this raise the question of tactics, though? You say, you use the word honesty. You feel that honesty is important here, too. But as a matter of securing for the Negro his rights, do you feel that this aggressiveness, this self-assertiveness, will get him more in the long run than going along with contemporary opinion and biding his time, taking step by step as he goes?
I think it's better to be aggressive at this point It seems to me that it is both historically and sociologically true that privileged classes do not give up their privileges voluntarily, and they do not give them up without strong resistance. And all of the gains that have been made, that we have received in the area of civil rights, have come about because the Negro stood up courageously for these rights, and he was willing to aggressively press on. So I would think that it would be much better in the long run to stand up and be aggressive with understanding, goodwill, and with a sense of discipline. Yet these things should not be substitutes for pressing on. And with this aggressive attitude, I believe that we will bring the gains or other civil rights into being much sooner than we would just standing idly by, waiting for these things to be given voluntarily.
Well, what about the ill will that's generated by the aggressiveness? Certainly your own experience in Montgomery. You have been the target of bomb attacks. You've been the target of verbal and other kinds of violence. What about the ill will that is generated by aggressiveness?
Well, I think that is a necessary phase of the transition. Whenever oppressed people stand up for their rights and rise up against the oppressor, so to speak, the initial response of the oppressor is bitterness. That's true in most cases, I think. And that is what we are now experiencing in the South, is this initial response of bitterness, which I hope will be transformed into a more brotherly attitude. We hope that the end will be redemption and reconciliation rather than division. But this, it seems to me, is a necessary phase of the transition from the old order of segregation and discrimination to the new order of freedom and justice. And this should not last forever. It's just something that's natural right now. And as soon as we pass out of the shock period into the more creative period of adjustment, I think that bitterness and ill will pass away.
This sounds, in a sense, to be, if I may say this, in a sense, to be a denial of the judicial process, saying we will work. The judicial process doesn't allow for the violent activity, the aggressiveness. And it means, in a sense, stepping outside, not outside the law, but outside that slow step-by-step process that has been going on in the courts. Do you think, for instance, that the courts would have been moved to action that would have taken the place of your boycott in Montgomery had you not acted? Do you think there could be a substitute for that kind of action?
I think not. I think it was necessary to do it. I think it was the time was right, and I don't think there could have been a substitute at that particular time.
Do you think that the judicial structure...
Mr. Hefner, I want to say something on that. I think undoubtedly the action that Mr. King and his friends took in Montgomery was fine, necessary, and effective. Remember, the courts don't go out as an executive branch of the government should and do things for you. The court declares what your rights are. And the court says to you, you're an American citizen. Now, of course, if you are scared and hide in a closet and don't exercise the rights of American citizens, the court can't send around and say you've got to do it. The courts have declared the rights, and I think that the Supreme Court decision of May 17th, 1954, was the greatest thing that's happened in this country in many, many decades. And I think that it declared in effect that segregation, legal segregation, segregation by law, is illegal and not a part of the American system. And all the people, the big people and the little people throughout this land, have awakened to the fact that they have a right. Now remember this, it's not a matter of giving rights. Rights aren't given. The right to vote isn't given to you. It's yours, and it belongs to you. And the Negro people are beginning to realize that they are ordinary human beings and American citizens, and they have these rights. And the courts have told them so. Now it's up to them to move out. They haven't got to go out with guns and bombs and bayonets, but they've got to go out with determination and courage and steadfastness, like this man Luther King has done, and say, here am I, and I stand here on my rights. And it's going to prevail, it's got to prevail, and it can't be beaten if we have enough of them who are steadfast enough. When they begin to compromise and sell out on principle, then they're gone. Now, it's a matter of strategy is to keep a complete, solid front. There may be tactics as to whether you want to make bus cases first or school cases or railroad cases or things of that kind. Those are minor details. But the strategy is you must never surrender any of the rights you've gained, and you must look forward to the attainment of full equality.
Well, I know that's your strategy. What about future tactics? Where do you go from here?
Well, that's pretty difficult question to answer at this point, since in Montgomery we have not worked out any future plans, that is, in any chronological order. We are certainly committed to work and press on until segregation is non-existent in Montgomery and all over the South. We are committed to full equality and doing away with injustice wherever we find it. But as to the next move, I don't have the answer for that, because we have not worked that out at this point. We, I guess, have been so involved in the bus situation until we have not had the real time to sit down and think about next moves. But in a general sense, we are committed to achieving first-class citizenship in every area of life in Montgomery and throughout the southern community.
Well, to what extent, this is a question that has occurred to me, I wondered to what extent the judicial decision of May 1954 stimulated a greater feeling of self-respect amongst Negroes and intensified in them a willingness to assert their demands.
I think it had a tremendous impact and influence on the Negro and bringing about this new self-respect. I think it certainly is one of the major factors, not the only. I think several other forces and historical circumstances must be brought into the picture. The fact that circumstances made it necessary for the Negro to travel more, so that his rural plantation background was gradually supplanted by a more urban industrial life. Illiteracy was gradually passing away, and with the growth of the cultural life of the Negro, that brought about new self-respect and economic growth, and also the tremendous impact of the world situation, with people all over the world seeking freedom from colonial powers and imperialism. These things all came together, and then with the decision of May 17, 1954, we gained the culminating point. That, it seems to me, was the final point which came and to bring all of these things together. And that gave this new Negro a new self-respect, which we see all over the South and all over the nation today.
Well, if this was a final point, in a sense, a culminating point, why do you ask now for another act on a national level, an act, let's say, on the part of the president for a speech in the South? Why is this so important? Haven't enough steps been made up to this point to enable you to carry the ball from here on?
Well, I think it's necessary for all of the forces possible to be working to implement and enforce the decisions that are handed down by the courts. And so often in the area of civil rights, it seems that the judicial branch of the government is fighting the battle alone. And we feel that the executive and legislative branches of the government have a basic responsibility. And at points, these branches have been all too silent and all too stagnant in their moves to implement and enforce the decisions. With the popularity of the president and his tremendous power and influence, just a word from him could do a great deal to ease the situation, calm emotions, and give Southern white liberals something to stand on if it is nothing but something to quote. The Southern white liberal stands in a pretty difficult position because he does not have anywhere to turn for emotional security, similar to what hate groups, I mean the things that other groups have to turn to, the hate organizations, so to speak. But with a word from the President of the United States, with his power and influence, it would give a little more courage and backbone to the white liberals in the South who are willing to be allies in the struggle with the Negro for first-class citizenship.
Now, to what extent, let me ask you this question, Judge Waring, are white Southerners willing to be allies in the battle of the new Negro?
That's a very hard question to answer. There are very, very few that are willing to come out in the open and say so. There are a great many, in my opinion, who would be glad if they are made to do it. I think that there are lots of people, I sometimes use the expression that the little boy with a dirty face won't go and wash it, but if you grab him by the neck and scrub his face, he then boasts he's got the cleanest face in the gang. And I think there are many of the people in the South, and I saw many of them. My experience was that officially I was quite hated and condemned because I had I'd expressed my views to what I thought the laws of the land were. And I got a lot of telephone messages and anonymous letters saying they agreed with me, but they couldn't tell me why or how or who they were. And those people want to be freed. But the overall picture of the politicians, no politician in the South is going to dare come out and take this position of his own volition. But if the President of the United States tells him so, he's going to fall in line. And if we can get the top executive people to take action, we'll get somewhere. Remember this now. The Supreme Court has laid down the law and said what's constitutional. Now, that's important. That's most important. It's the biggest thing that's ever happened. But it's got to be activative. It's got to be worked out, and the executive department has got to manipulate and work it and enforce it. And the legislative department should give the executive department more power to work and enforce these laws.
You feel that action, then you do too, feel that action has to be taken on this level.
Oh, yes, very definitely.
Let me ask again, though, about the feelings of the Southern whites. How do you evaluate? If you had to give a progress report, how would you evaluate the battle you fought over this past year? In terms of Southern feelings, in terms of Northern white feelings, too.
Well, I think we have seen, we've been able to see mixed emotions at this point. For instance, over from a national point of view, looking all over the nation, we have had tremendous response and real genuine sympathy from many, many white persons, and naturally we've had the sympathy of Negroes, but many, many white persons of goodwill all over the nation have given moral support and a great deal of encouragement, and that has been very encouraging to us in the struggle. Now, in the South, I guess the lines are more closely drawn. You find, on the one hand, a group more determined now than ever before, because it is a last-ditch struggle to do anything, even if it means using violence to to block all of the intentions and the desires of the Negro to achieve first-class citizenship. But there are also others who have expressed sympathy. There are white Southerners, even in Montgomery, who have been quite sympathetic. As Judge Warren just said, sometimes these people, because of fear, refuse to say anything about it. They stand back because of fear of economic, social, and political reprisals. But there is a silent sympathy. We have seen a great deal of that in Montgomery. So that it's two sides. There's this side where you get the negative response, the other side where you have the positive response, and I have seen both. And I think as time goes on, the negative side will get smaller and smaller, and those who are willing to be open-minded and accept the trends of the ages will grow into a majority group rather than a minority.
You don't feel that there'll be any violent reaction then over a long-range point of view to the progress that has been made?
No, I don't. I think the violence will be temporary. Maybe I don't say it will end tomorrow. We will go through some more for the next few months so. But I think once we are over the shock period, that shock will be absorbed, and Southerners will come to the point of seeing that the best thing to do is to sit down and work out these problems and do it in a very Christian spirit. I think the violence that we are undergoing now is indicative of the fact that the diehards realize that they are on they're standing at the dying point. That is, the system is at its dying point, and that this is a last way to try to hold on to the old order.
Mr. Hefner, all great reforms have periods of trouble. Gandhi was murdered. Jesus was crucified. And you find that most great reforms have certain periods of stress and distress. Now, just one last point I want to make. When we speak of the law, it's terribly important that we bring these cases and have a declaration of law, an action by Congress, an action by the executive. Because now, or up to the time of the Supreme Court's decision, segregation was legal. And segregation, even people of goodwill in the South said, but the law says we have to keep these people separate. For instance, it has been illegal for me to ride in a bus with Mr. King here. Now, I don't want a law that says I've got to ride with him or he's got to ride with me, but I don't want a law that says I can't sit in a seat with him. And we've broken that, and that's an enormous advance. And we've got to do it on every stage right down the line. The Congress of the United States, I believe, I've been very cynical and skeptical about it, but I'm beginning to believe they're going to do a little something this time. And if they do a little something, they haven't done anything in 75 years. If they do a little something this time, they'll do a little more next year. And the President of the United States and the officials in the administration will begin to see that if Congress is moving, it's good politics to move, and that'll have a great motivating product on the national picture. I think we are going forward. We are going forward inexorably. We've got to win. Now, it's a question whether we're going to win in a short time or a long time. I'm for the short term.
How do you project this into the immediate future?
Well, when I think of the question of progress in the area of race relations, I prefer to be realistic. And when I say that, I mean I try to look at it not from the pessimistic point of view or the optimistic, but rather from the realistic point of view. I think we've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go. But it seems to me that if we will press on with determination, moral courage, and yet wise restraint and calm reasonableness, in a few years we will reach the goal. I have a great deal of faith in the future and the outcome. I am not despairing.
And I'm sure as long as we have men like you, we can all have faith. Thank you so much, Reverend King, Judge Waring. Next week we'll give a summary report of civil rights over the past year. Gentlemen, I think that... did one very, very nicely.
WRCA has just presented The Open Mind. Our guests today were the Reverend Martin Luther King and Judge J. Waties Waring. Your host on The Open Mind is Richard D. Hefner. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, WRCA, New York 20.
I make my decisions on the basis of my moral commitment, and I take my ministry very seriously. I would not say that the civil rights movement is dead. It's simply that we are moving to a new phase of the movement. Well, now 12 years, we struggle to end legal segregation and all of the humiliation surrounding legal segregation. So it was a struggle for decency. It was a struggle to get rid of extremist behavior toward Negroes. Now we are in a new phase, and that is a phase where we are seeking genuine equality, where we are dealing with hard economic and social issues. And it means that the job is much more difficult. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to get a program that will force the government to put billions of dollars into ending slums. It's a wonderful thing to work and be concerned about integrating public accommodations, or integrating the public schools, which I will continue to work for with vigor and with zeal. But I've also got to be concerned about the survival of a world in which to be integrated. And these issues to me are tied together in that sense.
How did you arrive at this decision, and who influenced your thinking?
I thought about it for several months, and finally I went away to write a book in Jamaica, where I had a chance to reflect and meditate and do a great deal of thinking about the war in Vietnam. And I came to the conclusion then that I had no alternative but to take a vigorous stand against the war.
Dr. King, when you speak out against this war, do you speak as a Negro opponent of the war? Is there something especially anti-Negro or racist about the war that impels you to speak out?
I cannot overlook the fact that I am a Negro, and that this war is doing a great deal to destroy the lives of thousands and thousands of my brothers and sisters. We are dying physically in disproportionate numbers in Vietnam, some 22.4% of the deaths, even though we are only about 11% of the population. The other thing is that we are dying spiritually and psychologically in disproportionate numbers at home in the ghettos. And I think the war itself accounts for our constant spiritual and psychological death here at home.
I weighed the criticisms that I would get.
Yes, sir.
I thought about even the fact that some Negroes wouldn't understand, and some respectable Negro leaders who are more concerned about being invited to the White House than invited to the cause of justice would be against me. I weighed all of this. And as I weighed in it, as I prayed over it, something said to me that you got to speak on this issue. If you don't speak on it and others don't speak, I'm not going to give up. I'll have even the rocks to cry out against this war. It's an evil war. And no matter where it leads, no matter what abuses it may bring, I'm going to tell the truth.
time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom, there has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue, because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, It is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery, and I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed, and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us, not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation, is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This oft misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated when you tell the truth and take a stand. Sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7-8-year-old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? But I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last. Free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last with this faith. We'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Second floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle about a block from the hotel, but it was not immediately identified as the murder weapon. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week when a march led by Dr. King erupted in violence. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen, and police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence. I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well. I have just conveyed the sympathy of Ms. Johnson, myself, to his widow, Mrs. King. I know that every American of goodwill joins me in mourning the death of this outstanding leader and in praying for peace and understanding throughout this land. We can achieve nothing by lawlessness and divisiveness among the American people. It's only by joining together and only by working together can we continue to move toward equality and fulfillment for all of our people. I hope that all Americans tonight will search their hearts as they ponder this most tragic incident. I have canceled my plans for the evening. I am postponing my trip to Hawaii until tomorrow.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. At a federal court hearing today, the city tried to make permanent an injunction against the march. Police Director Frank Holloman testified that he had inside information that the Ku Klux Klan planned a countermarch. In his words, "I fear for the safety of the citizens of Memphis. It could be worse than Watts or worse than Detroit." Attorneys for Dr. King countered with a 9-point plan which they contended would prevent more rioting. During the violence which took over Dr. King's march in Memphis just 1 week ago, one young Negro was killed, 62 persons were injured, and 276 arrested. Dr. King himself, when it began, was surrounded by a protecting human wall of followers, put into a car, and quickly taken from the scene. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around.
There was shock in Harlem tonight when word of Dr. King's murder reached the nation's largest Negro community. Men, women, and children poured into the streets. They appeared dazed. Many were crying. The young Negro said, "Dr. King didn't really have to go back to Memphis. Maybe he wanted to prove something." Well, maybe he did. Dr. King, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, a leading exponent of nonviolence, had often risked danger, and he often said he would be willing to die for his cause.
The only way we can really achieve freedom is to somehow conquer the fear of death. But if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, something so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right and that which is just, and he refuses to stand up because he wants to live a little longer, and he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80. But he's just as dead as 36 as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. He died. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true. So we're going to stand up right here amid horses. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy club. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas. Yes. We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up, yes, letting the world know, yes, that we are determined to be free.
Dr. King won his first important civil rights victory in Alabama when he led the famed Montgomery bus boycott in 1956. His campaign led to integrated seating on city buses in the deep South city, and that, possibly more than any other feat, added new fuel to the surging civil rights movement in the 1950s and beyond. CBS News will present a special program on Dr. King at 11 o'clock Eastern Time tonight over many of these stations.
We want to do a tune written for today, for this hour, for Dr. Martin Luther King. We stated before that the whole program is dedicated to his memory, but this tune is written about him and for him. So, we had yesterday to learn it, and so we'll see. Once upon this planet Earth, lived a man. Preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah. Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? Cause he'd seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, cause we're headed for the brink. Now is for equality for all people, you and me. Full of love and goodwill, hate was not his way. He was not a violent man. Bigotry had sealed his face. We can all shed tears, but it won't change a thing. Teach your people, will they ever learn? Must you always kill with burn and burn with guns and kill with guns and burn? Don't you know how we got to react? Don't you know what it will bring? But he had seen the mountaintop. He could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think. Everybody knows we're on the brink. Happen now that the king's dead. I'm gonna say he'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel again. Are we headed for the brink? What's gonna happen now in all of our cities? Our people are rising. At that one moment that you know what life is. If you have to die, it's alright, 'cause you know what life is. You know what freedom is for one moment of your life. What's gonna happen now that the king of love of stories, but I heard that this was his favorite song, Beast at the near the end of his life. Last year, a year ago, maybe more longer than that now, Lorraine Hansberry left us, and she was a dear friend. And she had her favorite song, and then Langston Hughes left us, Coltrane left us, Otis Redding left us. You can go on. Do you realize how many we have lost? Then it really gets down to reality, doesn't it? Not a performance. Not microphones and all that crap. But really something else. We've lost a lot of them in the last 2 years. But we have remaining Monk, Miles. I love you too. And of course, for those that we have left, we're thankful, but we can't afford any more losses. Oh no. Oh my God. They're shooting us down one by one. Don't forget that. Because they are. Killing us one by one. Well, all I have to say is that those of us who know how to protect those of us that we love, stand by them and stay close to them. And I say that if there'd been a couple more, a little closer to Dr. King, he wouldn't have got it. You know, really. Just a little closer to him. Stay there. Stay there. We can't afford any more losses. He had seen mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat. Dead ahead. Come on, Sam. Folks, you better stop that man. Or we're almost to the brain.
need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this morning and to have the opportunity of standing in this very great and significant pulpit. It is always a rich and rewarding experience to take a brief break from our day-to-day demands in the struggle for freedom and human dignity, and discuss the issues involved in that struggle with concerned friends of goodwill all over our nation. And certainly it is always a deep and meaningful experience to be in a worship service. And so for many reasons, I'm happy to be here today. I would like to use as a subject from which to preach this morning, remaining awake through a great revolution. And the text for the morning is found in the book of Revelation. There are two passages there that I would like to quote. It's in the 16th chapter of that book. Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. I'm sure that most of you have read that arresting little story from the pen of Washington Irving, entitled Rip Van Winkle. The one thing that we usually remember about the story is that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years. But that is another point in that little story that is almost always completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. When Rip Van Winkle went up in the mountain, the sign had a picture of King George III of England. When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. And Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitude, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. And they end up sleeping through a revolution. Now, there can be no gainsaying of the fact that the great revolution has taken place in the world today, in the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. Then that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. And that is still a voice crying through the vista of time, saying, "Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away." Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. And I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that has taken place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. And anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has coming to be into a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood. And yet, we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in tide of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We must see this, believe this, and live by it. If we are to remain awake through a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent than for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. And everyone must share in the guilt, as individuals and as institutions. The government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning when we stand to sing, "In Christ there is no east nor west." We stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody, and for all institutions, for the public sector and the private sector, to work to get rid of racism. Now, if we are to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. It is a notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And there are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, "Why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. And if you will just be nice and patient and continue to pray, in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out." Well, that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme rightists of our nation, the people on the wrong side, have used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, "Wait on time." Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time and realize that the time is always right to do right. Now, that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. And there are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, if the Negro is to rise out of slum conditions, if he is to rise out of discrimination and segregation, he must do it all by himself. And so they say the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stop to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. The people who say this never stop to realize that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stop to realize the debt that they owe a people who were kept in slavery 244 years. In 1863, the Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. But he was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. And you just go up to him and say, now you are free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. And yet this is the very thing that our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left them there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time that the nation failed to do anything for the black man, through an act of Congress, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land grant colleges to teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, the years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could mechanize our farms. And to this day, thousands of these very persons are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies every year not to farm. And these are so often the very people who tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. We must come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country. And there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism and the tragedies of racial injustice. Now, that is another thing closely related to racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. 2/3 of the people of the world go to bed hungry tonight. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet and talk with the great leaders of India. And to meet and talk with and speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. And these experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But I say to you this morning, my friends, there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Bombay, more than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population of more than 500 million people, some 480 million make an annual income of less than $90 a year, and most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I notice these things, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no, because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking of the fact that we spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children all over the world who go to bed hungry at night. And maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. But not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you that in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the north. And I've seen them in the rural areas of the south. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring in many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I have literally found myself crying. I was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, the poorest county in the United States. I tell you, I saw hundreds of little black boys and black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a little Head Start program, but they had no money. The federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. And I saw mothers and fathers who said to me, not only were they unemployed, but they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check or anything. I said, how do you live? And they say, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we pick berries. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch a few rabbits. And that's about it. I was in Newark and Harlem just this week, and I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. I saw them in conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, but wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment, and this welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years. He had made a single repair.
She pointed out her little boy who was the victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls with all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the holes where the rats came in. And she said, night after night, we have to stay awake. Keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. And I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. Poor people are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. And the tragedy is, so often, these 40 million people are invisible because America is so affluent, so rich, because our expressways carry us away from the ghetto, we don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day, and he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't see the poor. His name was Dives. He was a rich man. And there was a man by the name of Lazarus who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body. He was so weak that he could hardly move. But he managed to get to the gate of Dives every day, wanting just to have the crumbs that would fall from his table. Dives did nothing about it. And the parable ends saying, Dives went to hell, and there was a fixed gulf now between Lazarus and Dives. And that is nothing in that parable which says that Dives went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him, and he advised him to sell all, but in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell. And on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Dives in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day. So it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Dives didn't go to hell because he was rich. Dives didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Dives went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Dives went to hell because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. Indeed, Dives went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. And this can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of hurt and neglect. We're going to bring those who've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. We're going to bring children and adults and old people. People who've never seen a doctor or a dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to tear up Washington. We're coming to demand the government will address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. We are coming to ask America to be true to the huge promissory note that it signed years ago. And we are coming to engage in dramatic non-violent action to call attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment, to make the invisible visible. Why do we do it this way? We do it this way because it is our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor and for black people until it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action. Great documents are here to tell us something should be done. We met here some years ago in the White House Conference on Civil Rights, and we came out with the same recommendations that we will be demanding in our campaign here, but nothing has been done. The President's Commission on Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress recommended these things some time ago. Nothing has been done. Even the urban coalition made up of mayors of most of the cities of our country and the leading businessmen have said that these things should be done. Nothing has been done. The Kerner Commission came out with its report just a few days ago and then made specific recommendations. Nothing has been done. And I submit that nothing will be done until people of goodwill put their bodies and their souls in motion. And it will be the kind of soul force brought into being as a result of this confrontation that I believe will make the difference. Yes, it will be a poor people's campaign. This is a question facing America. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. America has not met its obligations and its responsibilities to the poor. One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. Yes, we will be able to say, we build gargantuan bridges to span the seas. We build gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Yes, we made our submarines to penetrate oceanic depths. We brought into being many other things with our scientific and technological power. And it seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked and ye clothed me not. I was devoid of a decent sanitary house to live in, and ye provided no shelter for me. And consequently, you cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. If ye do it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye do it unto me. That's the question facing America today. And I want to say one other challenge that we face is simply that we must find an alternative to war and bloodshed. Anyone who feels, and there are still a lot of people who feel that way, that war can solve the social problems facing mankind, is sleeping through a revolution. President Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. The world must hear this. I pray God that America will hear this before it is too late, because today we are fighting a war. I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world. Our involvement in the war in Vietnam has torn up the Geneva Accord. It has strengthened the military-industrial complex. It has strengthened the forces of reaction in our nation. It has put us against the self-determination of the vast majority of Vietnamese people and put us in a position of protecting a corrupt regime that is stacked against the poor. It has played havoc with our domestic destinies. And this day we are spending $500,000 to kill every Viet Cong soldier. Every time we kill one, we spend about $500,000, while we spend only $53 a year for every person characterized as poverty-stricken in the so-called poverty program, which is not even a good skirmish against poverty. But not only that, it has put us in a position of appearing to the world as an arrogant nation. And here we are 10,000 miles away from home, fighting for the so-called freedom of the Vietnamese people when we've not even put our own house in order. And we force young black men and young white men to fight and kill in brutal solidarity. Yet when they come back home, they can't hardly live on the same block together. The judgment of God is upon us today. And we could go right down the line and see that something must be done, and something must be done quickly. We have alienated ourselves from other nations, so we end up morally and politically isolated in the world. There's not a single major ally to the United States of America that would dare send a troop to Vietnam, and so the only friends that we have now are a few client nations like Taiwan, Thailand, South Korea, and a few others. This is where we are. Mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind, and the best way to start is to put an end to the war in Vietnam, because if it continues, we will inevitably come to the point of confronting China, which could lead the whole world to nuclear annihilation. It is no longer the choice, my friends, between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or nonexistence, and the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat will be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. This is why I felt the need raising my voice against that war and working wherever I can to arouse the conscience of our nation on it. I remember so well when I first took a stand against the war in Vietnam. The critics took me on and they had their say in the most negative and sometimes most vicious way. One day a newsman came to me and said, "Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to stop now opposing the war and move more in line with the administration's policy? Because I understand that it has hurt the budget of your organization and people who once respect you have lost respect. People who once respected you have lost respect for you. Don't you feel that you really got to change your position?" I looked at him and I had to say, "Sir, I'm sorry you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or by taking a sort of Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a mold of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is expedient? And then expediency comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? And conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular. But he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And I believe today that there is a need for all people of goodwill to come with a massive act of conscience and say, in the words of the old Negro spiritual, we ain't gonna study war no more. This is the challenge facing modern man. Let me close by saying that we have difficult days ahead in the struggle for justice and peace. But I will not yield to a politic of despair. I'm going to maintain hope. As we come to Washington in this campaign, the cards are stacked against us. This time we will really confront a Goliath. God grants that we will be that David of truth set out against the Goliath of injustice, the Goliath of neglect, the Goliath of refusing to deal with the problems, and go on with a determination to make America the truly great America that it is called to be. I say to you that our goal is freedom. And I believe we're going to get there. Because however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be as a people, our destiny is tied up in the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king, and they built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. And yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continue to grow and develop. If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom because both the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands. And so however dark it is, however deep the angry feelings are and the violent explosions are, I can still sing, we shall overcome. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right, as we were singing earlier today. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet, that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. Thank God for John, who centuries ago out on a lonely, obscure island called Patmos, caught vision of the New Jerusalem descending out of heaven from God, who heard a voice saying, "Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away." God grant that we will be participants in this newness and this magnificent development. If we will but do it, we will bring about a new day of justice and brotherhood and peace. And that day the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy. God bless you.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive.